always enjoyed his talks, and I'm sure that you get as much out of his talk as I do. So it was my pleasure to introduce David A. from Dallas, Texas. Thank you, Bobby. Hi, everybody. My name's David A., and I am an alcoholic. And only because of God's grace is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to, nor have I taken a drink of an alcoholic nature since April the 20th, 1967, and for this I am so thankful. And first of all, I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come and share me with you and you with me at this lovely facility here in Gulf Shores, Alabama. And I want to thank Dale and Bobby for being kind enough to meet me at the airport and drive me over here to Gulf Shores and visit with me. And there are many, many in this room that I dearly love. And so it has been a very, very wonderful weekend up to now. The only thing I know about being an alcoholic is how I drank. And the only thing I know about living sober is Alcoholics Anonymous. And since April the 20th, 1967, I have not found any reason whatever to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, to find an easier way to live sober, a more sociably acceptable way to live sober, a more fun way to live sober, a more comfortable way to live sober, or a more desirous way to live sober. Thank God I have not had to leave AA to go to an action-reaction course, concentration movement, related disorders institute, hang in there till your drawers fall off, baby. Sexual dysfunction seminar. If you get as old as I am and stay sober as long as I have, you don't need a sexual dysfunction seminar. You need a memory course. All the principles that I have found to live sober, I have found in the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know any other way to live sober. And the only way I know how to make an AA talk is so beautifully read just a few seconds ago from a portion of Chapter 5 that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. Well, it was on the last Sunday in August of 1950, over 34 years ago, that a group of fine, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous invited me to come to an AA open meeting at the Suburban Group in Dallas, Texas. The Wednesday before that Sunday, I stumbled into one of Dallas's more affluent barbershops, and I was more at myself that morning. Now, being more at myself in those days meant that I was drinking. I wasn't too drunk. I could sit in a chair for 10 minutes without falling out of it. I could navigate to and from the men's room and go out and get me another bottle of whiskey. And I sat down at this manicurist table, and this lady looked at me, and she said, "David," and right there and then I should have known something's wrong. She didn't call me doctor. She said, "David, I belong to a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have not had a drink of alcohol in a year." And I looked at Edith, and I said, "You're a liar. Nobody stays sober a year, maybe a day, maybe 2 days, maybe 3 days, but certainly not here." She says, "No, I haven't had a drink in a year." Now, Edith looked like a drunk ought to look like, you know. Sorry, female-looking Bobby over here, you know. Her face wasn't real pretty. It looked like a truck had run over it and then backed over to see if it had done a good job. She had big bug eyes and gaps in her teeth, and God bless her, she had been hit in the face so many times and fallen on her face so many times, and her nose had been broken so many times, just sort of hung on the left side of her face. Now, this is back in the days before the gals used to wear pantyhose, used to wear garter belts. And when she was drinking, hers always trailed behind her uniform. She'd trip and fall, drop all those manicuring bottles. And that's back in the days when the gals used to wear, you know, hose with the seams up the back. You could always tell when Edith was drunk. The seams in the front was in the back. But God, she's a great girl. The best way I can describe Edith's looks is a drunk. You know, in our part of the country, if your car is caught out in a hailstorm and it's pretty badly beaten up, right when you get your insurance check, if you have insurance, some wise buzzard says, "Don't get it fixed. Let it sit out in the hot sun for about 3 or 4 weeks and all the dents will pop back out." Her dents never pop back out. But God, she was a great gal. She was a great... But when she told me she hadn't had a drink in a year, you know, and I had stumbled in this shop on infrequent occasions, sometimes drunker than I was that morning. Sometimes not as drunk, but always drinking. But she got my attention, and I started watching her. And when she said she was sober a year, because she was an incorrigible alcoholic when she was drinking. And God, and I looked at her, and I noticed something different. That when she started giving my manicure that morning, she was buffing my nails instead of my knuckles as she used to. I looked at her face, and her lipstick was on her lips and not eyebrows. And I sniffed her, and she didn't smell halfway between an Avon woman and a whiskey bottle. But more important, she didn't grab her purse and say, I'll be back in 10 minutes, and show up 4 months later, you know. But I noticed the change, and the change was in her eyes. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have two kinds of eyes. We have those sad, sick eyes. And then we have those happy, dancing, laughing, sparkling, sober eyes. And then we got another kind of eyes, them glassy eyes. They'll get up behind one of these things and say, I haven't had a drink, you know, and then fall over. But her eyes were jumping, and they were laughing and sparkling, and she looked like she was having a lot of fun living sober. And then she introduced me to another lady by the name of Melina. She says, Melina here is my sponsor, and she has 15 months sober in this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked at Melina, because I had drunk far more whiskey with Melina I had with Edith, and I looked at Edith and I said, Melina, you're a bigger liar than Edith. I said, we had a drink, not, and she says, no, David, I have not had a drink of alcohol with you or anyone else or myself in 15 continuous months. Edith has not had a drink of alcohol in 12 continuous months. And we have an open meeting this Sunday at 5:30. And it's open so the public can come and, open to the public, they can come and see how an alcoholic, how Alcoholics Anonymous will work for an alcoholic. What Alcoholics is and what Anonymous is and what Alcoholics Anonymous is not. And you know, even today, right this second, all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous, that one of the biggest challenges that we have within Alcoholics Anonymous, that thousands and thousands of our members do not know what we are not. And this causes a lot of confusion to the unknown public who send more alcoholics to us than anything else in the world, who we are and what we are. And I don't know the reason, whatever it is, but it's here, and it certainly is, and it's a challenge. And we have no problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have challenges, and we hear all the time, let's go back to basics. The challenge is maintain the basics, and you don't have to go back to something that you don't leave. And if AA gets more complicated than that, I'm going to have to go get me another deal, but I had many, many years to go before I had to realize this. I certainly did. And she said, now all of the participants on that meeting will be members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And since it is the last Sunday of the month, and although we do not give any awards or medals for our sobriety, afterwards has nothing to do with the AA meeting per se or such, because it is not Alcoholics Anonymous, but afterwards, the group has sort of, for those who have one or more years of continuous sobriety, they have a little social, and they have ice cream and cake and tea and punch and all that thing. And we would like for you and your wife to come to that open AA meeting and stay afterwards. And the only reason that I thought that people such as you would invite someone such as me to come to one of your AA meetings or AA functions is that you needed to have some good-looking, outstanding, and successful professional man come and upgrade you lepers in the community. And I'm glad to come help you. So I went home and I told my wife, and now unbeknownst to me, there was an alcoholic by the name of Al Badger. And Al got sober in the middle 40s and right at the end of 44 and 45. And Al ran a very successful and a very fine restaurant in downtown Dallas. And Al was a tremendous man. And unbeknownst to me, until after I got sober many years later, and that they tried to net me back in when I got out of the service the first time in 1947 and 1948 and 1949, and they set the trap in 1950. And so I went home and told my wife, Grace, and God, she was thrilled because people had long since quit asking us to come around. My wife used to ask me, why isn't it we're not asked to the outdoor barbecues, square dances, round dances, 42, 84 parties, card parties, swimming pool parties, nightclub suppers, pin the tail on the donkey, what drunks do on Saturday night? And I said, it's you, it's you. I said, every time we're asked to go out on Saturday night, you start on me on the Monday before, you start screaming at me, you're not going to drink, you're not going to get drunk, are you? And you wake me up out of a sound sleep, 4:30 the next morning, screaming, did you hear what I said? And you keep it up All day Tuesday, Tuesday night, Wednesday, Wednesday night, Thursday, Thursday night. And what a tremendous price society has had to pay. Those who love us, those who hate us, those who don't even care we exist on this earth. What a tremendous price society has had to pay to find out that the more you scream at a drunk about their drinking, the more we're going to drink. I says, and furthermore, when we get where we're supposed to get, before I can even park the car, you're out of the car, you run in, you grab the host and the hostess, and you chase them out of the kitchen, through the den, through their backyard, through the alley, through the neighborhood, and the bushes, screaming, don't you give him a drink? Woman, you're sick, that's what's wrong with you. But through tear-filled eyes, she says, are we going to the meeting? And I says, yes. And so that Sunday morning, I got up at 5:30 to get ready to go to an AA meeting, 5:30 that afternoon. Well, now, what does a good, self-respectful drinking drunk do when he gets up 5:30 on Sunday morning? Drinks whiskey, that's what he does. Let's face it, it's very simple. Golfers golf, fishermen fish, drunks drink. There's no big mystery to it. And I started sucking on a brand new bottle of whiskey. You know how it is when you take that first drink, get your breathing started. And then that second drink regulates your breathing. Then that third drink goes down to both heels and just sets you there. Now you're ready to do some real drinking, aren't you? And I'm drinking and I'm looking up at the birds and the bees and the trees and everything. And I'm hearing the neighbors screaming, Johnny, you get ready, we'll be late for church. And I said, oh, them sick people. They don't know what living is. If they could learn how to enjoy it and controlling it like I was doing, that they would find out that right after drinking in and out, it's the greatest gift that man been ever given. And then I started doing my meditating and praying. Now, we hear it in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time, that due to the innate nature of our spiritual illness, our selfishness, our self-centeredness, that we care very little God for prayer and meditation. And I disagree with you, because I used to thank God for the grain. I thank God for the farmers that harvested the grain. I thank God for the distillers that made that grain and that wonderful thing called alcohol. We hear it in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. Once again, due to the innate nature of our spiritual illness, our vanity, our pride, our ego, that we care very, very little for the common welfare of our fellow man, I disagree with you. Because I used to ask God to show a special love and kindness and concern for those folks who thought that drinking alcohol was sinful. And amen. And I took me another drink. And I drank about half of that bottle of whiskey and put the other half in the fifth of my trunk because I knew at that time that I was going to be required to have another drink of alcohol. Not knowing the exact reason until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of these that firmly believes that if and when an alcoholic comes to us, that until and unless that alcoholic is willing to find out what's wrong with that alcoholic, that alcoholic will never be able to find out what can get right with that alcoholic. And I went in and I bathed and I shaved and I put on everything rich and nice looking to impress those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I put on a beautiful brand new tailor-made suit, white on white monogram shirt, monogram handkerchief, monogram tie, monogram drawers. Put on my diamond ring, my diamond watch, and the trademark of every good, self-respectful, high-rolling, drinking drunk. A brand new pair of custom-made alligator shoes. I look just like a used car salesman. And at 10:30 in the morning, I'm out in my long Roadmaster Buick honking the horn. And out comes my wife with the rollers in her hair. And she has on, it's that all-your-fault kimono that they just love to live in and dwell in and cry in, and where she had lost a string around the middle and she had it pinned together with a big baby diaper pin. And she pulled out all the fuzzing and the padding and the strings and the buttons off the front. And the front just covered with tear stains and cigarette burns. And she looks at me and she says, what do you want, drunk? Meanwhile, all the neighbors had gathered out. And her side is lined up over here, and my side is lined up over here. And I can still hear those fine ladies of the neighborhood saying, isn't it a shame that such a beautiful and fine lady and the mother of two beautiful little boys married to such a sorry, no-good drunk like him? And my bunch over here hollering out, let her have it, David, let her have it. And that used to be the weekend entertainment in every neighborhood we lived in. We moved 24 times before we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes at midnight. Sometimes at high noon. Sometimes at daybreak. Sometimes ahead of the sheriff, sometimes with the sheriff, sometimes behind the sheriff, just kept moving. And I said, let's go to the meeting. And she said, it doesn't get started for 7 more hours, drunk. And with that, she turned on her heels and went back into the house, and that started 7 tough hours because I violated a very serious code in my drinking that Sunday. Because here I was, I started drinking on the only bottle of whiskey I had. I drank a half of it. I had the other half of that fifth in the trunk of my car. I knew I was going to be required to have a drink of alcohol. And I was one of those kind that once I started drinking, I just drank. And I drank and I drank and I was a disappearing drunk. And I'd end up in places and with people and not knowing how I got there. I remember one time I was gone 9 months. No one knew where I was. My mother, my father, my wife, my children, my patients, my enemies. Nobody knew where I was. And I come running in the house with the same clothes I'd been in for around about 6 to 8 weeks. And I run in and I ask my wife this brilliant question. Did anybody call? And that does not make for good marriage relationships, I'll tell you. And so I knew that if I touched that bottle of whiskey, I knew I was going to have it. I knew if I wanted to get any more alcohol that I'd either have to call a bootlegger or a taxi cab. But my ego demanded that I take my wife to that so-called AA meeting where those people said that they were alcoholic and that they hadn't had a drink, just in case that those two ladies who told me they were alcoholics and invited me to come, us to come, and we were going to meet with other people of the same condition, just in case that they mildly suspicioned that I may have just a minor problem with drinking alcohol, that I wanted to bring them the reason and show them the reason, and that was my wife. But I knew that if I slipped off, I'd blow the deal. So I just started, you know, finding something here to kind of nurse me along. And that's the toughest work I ever did in my wife was to, life is to try to drink and stay sober. Now, that's hard work. Finally, I found enough just to kind of keep the buzz going. And at 4:30, I honked the horn. Here she came, and off we went. And we went out to the meeting, and we walked in, and it looked like there's about 80 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and their wives, and a kid, and a poodle or two jumping up and down, and everybody smoking cigarettes, and everybody talking. And I looked at those people, and I said, if they ain't drinking their own dope. And then I looked around, and I saw that sign, but for the grace of God, and my head ducked. Because I knew at that time that I was not living according to the dictates of God's will for a human being. And I'm one of these that firmly believes that when an alcoholic comes to us, even though many of us come to Alcoholics Anonymous without a full string of lights, that once we get physically sober, that deep down inside, every one of us know this. Because if this be not the case, then Alcoholics Anonymous would not be the most precious, the finest recovery program and for a fellowship that the world has seen, is seeing, or ever will see. Because Alcoholics Anonymous does something that organized religion on a continuing basis has not been able to do it with alcoholics. Medicine has not been able to do it with alcoholics. Psychiatry has not been able to do it with alcoholics. Social services have not been able to do it with alcoholics. Governments have not been able to do it with alcoholics. Because Alcoholics Anonymous reaches down into a place that comes with each and every one of us when we're born. This little thing that after we get physically comfortable says, thank you, little drunk, for not taking a drink of alcohol today. Thank you, little drunk, for finding a way to have a reasonable good night's sleep. But more important, thank you, little drunk, for finding a group of people who love you no matter what you have done, what you are doing, or what you ever will do. And that is where the great power of our society lies. One drunk talking to another. But I had many, many years to go before I was to realize this. And then I looked around and I saw the rest of them signs and I said, my God, I'm in a kindergarten. And then I saw what I then believe and still believe to be the most dangerous sign you can put in an AA facility or an AA group, and that's the one that says, think. Because it's dangerous for our kind of folks to think drunk, sober, or dead. And if you don't believe it, you pat a little drunk on the head and tell him how good he's doing in Alcoholics Anonymous or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And let him get over in a corner and start thinking for himself. And he'll get drunker than an $8 bill on you. They blew a whistle, everybody went in the meeting, and I went and I sat on the back row to look over those people to see what kind of help I could afford to give them. And the first speaker that got up, talker got up, was a woman, and I took one look at her, and I fell out of my chair. Because that's a lying, this cheating person I'd ever been around in my life, and that lady had nerve enough to stand up in front of 80 people and say she was sober, sane, in her right mind, and had not had a drink of alcohol in a year. And I jumped up and I screamed out, "You're a liar." And somebody says, "Shut up." You know how a wet drunk answers you when you tell him to shut up? "Make me." They had enough there to make me. And then this woman started talking about a miracle, 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 miracle. What seemed to me like 10 minutes on this one word, miracle. And this time, I couldn't say, this time I got up on the chair. And I pointed to her and I says, "Tell it, you big liar." And this time the put down, the shut up was firmer. And then this lady says, as a result of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, she called Christ back in her life. And if anyone who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, unless they found that Christ is the truth and Jesus is their power greater than themselves, that there was no way in this world that they could stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself at that time, what a heck of a trick to put on a Jew. That y'all invited me to this deal to convert me, and if this is where I needed a drink bad. And I'm asked all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous, how come there are not any more Jews in Alcoholics Anonymous than what there is? Well, you see, it's very simple. You see, the way people have their noses fixed and their names changed, you don't know who you're sitting next to in an AA meeting. Now, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we ain't got Jews, we ain't got Catholics, we ain't got Protestants, we ain't got agnostics, atheists, blacks, polka dots, anything. Straight, half and half. Thank God there ain't but one kind of alcoholic in AA and sober, and that's a member. That's a member. Thank God. That makes us all inclusive and not exclusive. But I had many, many years to go before I realized this. I certainly did. But my mind closed when she said that, and I didn't hear anything else that was said at that meeting, because I started working with, get drunk with, fighting with, cheat with, the black and the white wino, which was then Skid Row, it's Skid Row today, and I guess it'll always be Skid Row in Dallas, Texas. And I lived on 3 Skid Rows my lifetime. One for over 6 years, one for over 4.5 years, but the last one for 14 months was the toughest. And I'm not going to stand up here tonight and share life on Skid Row with you, but the Skid Row that I lived on, there was no day and there was no night. And there was no sky and there was no moon and there was no stars and there was no clouds and there was no sun. And there was no seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, just total inner and outer blackness and darkness. And the best way I can describe that kind of an existence is just bodies and feet. You don't care if you live, you don't care if you die. You don't care if you bathe, you don't care if you don't bathe. You don't care if you work, you don't care if you don't work. You don't care if you eat, you don't care if you don't eat. You don't care if you change clothes, you don't care if you don't change clothes. You just don't care. And an alcoholic cannot stay on Skid Row. An alcoholic has got to get off of Skid Row. Because an alcoholic will lie about whether he's got a bottle or not. An alcoholic will lie whether he's drinking or not. An alcoholic will not share his bottle out because he's afraid he's going to run out. And if you lie about your drinking and you don't share your bottle down on the road, you're not long for this earth, I don't mind telling you. And I did not have to be down there because I came from one of the finest families that God ever put on this earth. As a son, I was blessed with the most beautiful mother and father that any son could ever wish for, hope for, and desire for. A mother and father who dedicated their lives to give to the two sons that were born of this, their marriage and I being the oldest, everything that was denied them when they were growing up. And if one of the sons is going to become an alcoholic, I don't know of a better deal when you've got a mother and father that's willing to go to any length to bail you out of every kind of problem that you've got. And 14.5 years before I got sober, in the religion my mother and father were born in, lived in, died in, and very devout, they lit the candles of the dead and said the prayers of the dead for 7 consecutive days. And on the 8th day, their son was no longer alive in their mind. He was dead as far as they were concerned. And that was the greatest thing in the world that they could have done for them about me. That was total release. And after I got sober and I wrote my 4-step inventory and I looked and I wrote about the resentments and the hates that I had against my father and mother because the way they treated me in deference to my brother. And then I realized this, that up until the time my mother and father prayed me dead, that they were the worst parents I could have possibly had because they never allowed me to fall. They broke every fall I ever had. And thank God they lived sober long enough to see this son, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a daughter-in-law, the most tremendous person I've ever known, my wife, in Al-Anon, and two sons that have grown up to be absolutely two of the most successful young men right now that I personally know. And I didn't have anything to do with it because I blew it all. I had nothing to do with it. And we hear it all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I deserve to be sober. I deserve this. I don't know about you, I don't deserve to be sober, and I don't deserve to be alive, and I don't deserve to be running loose in this world. If I'd have gotten what I really deserved, I would have been murdered or electrocuted long ago or locked up in a maximum goonie roost running up and down them cages with my toes and my fingers babbling like a gorilla the rest of my life. And so I've been given a gift, an unmerited, undeserved gift, only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had many, many years to go before I realized this. I certainly did. And I started down on Skid Row as a youngster, 10 and a half years of age, and I started drinking bay rum and wine. That was the standard fare. And later on, as I grew older, physically get more money in my pocket, I could go from that bay rum and that wine to that good stuff and never miss a lick, and come back down from that good stuff down to Gypsy Rose and Thunderbird and never miss a lick. Because I don't know about anybody in here, I was not drinking it because of the price of it. I wasn't drinking it because of the smell of it. I wasn't drinking it because it was socially acceptable. I wasn't drinking it because it'll make you a better dancer, better fighter, worse fighter, better this, worse that. I was drinking it because I liked what it did to and with me and for me when it got in and down and through me, and I liked what it allowed me to do to and with you or against you when it got in and down and through me. And little did I realize that the first drink of alcohol that I took, that affected my, consciously affected my head. My head said, David, every chance you're going to get, you're going to take a drink of alcohol. And I did not know this. I learned a lot of things down on Skid Row. Never get your back up against the wall that didn't have a back door or window that you can jump out of. You drank that wine like I did. That wine will hang you without a rope. I don't mind telling you. And I've always been 5'6". I was born 5'6". And I'd drink that juice and I'd be 7 foot tall. And I've had thousands of fights, never won a one. My nose has been where my navel is. My navel's been where right here. I've been all rearranged. When I was 14, 15, 16, and 17, I ran off and joined Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey's Circus. And back in those days, the Ringling Show was the finest show under canvas in this entire world. And God, it would have been a thrill for a youngster to go with the circus in those days, because we'd come to a town, you know, like Birmingham and Louisville and Richmond, Virginia and Indianapolis and St. Louis, and the animals would drag the wagons through the main street and the calliope would go in, and all the clowns and all the Wild West riders and the wild animals. Not me. I went because you could drink and because you can fight. And I look around here and I don't see any circus-looking drinkers. I learned to drink the most beautiful concoction in the circus that's ever been devised by a man, called Green Lizard Circus Style. Oh, that's a tremendous drink. That's elixir of sodium bromide and Lucky Tiger hair tonic, you know. And I used to drink that stuff, and I'd see Bambi and those animals long before Walt Disney ever put them on the screen. But you see, I'm trying to live three codes of living. I'm trying to live the code of living that society is demanding that I live, and go to school and become a useful human being, and not get into jails, and not get into institutions, and not cause the heartaches to the people whom I love the most, who love me the most, and be a useful citizen to my city and county and state and country in which I'm living in. And I became a total failure in all those respects. Then I'm trying to live the code of living my mother and father wanted me to live, because they had all the money. And if you'd already been in all the trouble I had been in, was in, and getting ready to get into, it takes a lot of money to get you out so you can get back in it again. And then I'm trying to live the code of living that alcohol was demanding all my life, and you're way ahead of me. You know which one went out. And there I am. I'm sitting on that back row, and there's not a window. There's not a back door to jump out or run out of. And that woman talking about Christ, and I'm wanting to drink bad. And I had a half of that Bod Fifth in the trunk of my car, and every time I stood up to walk through those 80 people to go out to get me a drink of alcohol, it looked like 80 people stood up, turned around, pointing fingers at me, and said, "Shut up and sit here and listen, and this is for you." And I hated every member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was in that meeting and the ship that brung them over, because they would not let me and give me a drink. And I made a deal right there with Alcoholics Anonymous that if they were not going to give me a drink right there in that meeting, or let me go out to my car and take a good drink and come back in, that I was not going to listen to anything that those people had to say. And that deal darn near killed me. And it wasn't until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous 17 years later. And I pray and I hope that I stay sober one day at a time. Then I found out what was wrong. And when I came in, and they shoved a book in my hand called Alcoholics Anonymous. May I remind every member of Alcoholics Anonymous in this meeting right this second. Every member of Al-Anon, Alateen, or if we have those who love us that are not members of any of our fellowships, we cooperate but don't affiliate the fellowships. Because the strength of Alcoholics Anonymous lies in the singleness of purpose. The strength of Al-Anon lies in the singleness of their purpose. The strength of Alateen lies in the singleness of their purpose. And Alcoholics Anonymous cannot be all things for all men. And this is the reason that the traditions that were read prior to the opening of this meeting are that me getting up here. And they were written not because of our good behavior, because of our bad behavior. When AA tried to be all things for all men and found out that we were headed down the wrong direction. But I still had many, many years to go before I was to realize this. I certainly did. And they shoved this book in my hand and reminded all of us that it is the only book in print with the two words on it. As John said this morning, it was from the name of the book, that's where the name of our fellowship came. However, prior to the book that was written, the two words were used a little bit frequently in the Cleveland area and also basically in the New York area, not knowing what to call it. And that Fitz Mayo, who went down to Washington and wrote mine, and there was another little story, they were going to call it The Grapevine. And then they come to find out that the FBI has a publication called The Grapevine. And when the FBI found out about it, the FBI didn't want anything to do with the drunks, and the drunks certainly didn't want to do anything with the FBI. And so you say, well, you have a magazine called The Grapevine, but you know how that was resolved? Ours is called The Alcoholics Anonymous Grapevine. And the others is just a grapevine, and the FBI was real happy that we put the two A's in front of it, and that's the reason that it's called the grapevine today. And I didn't know this. I had many, many years to go before I was to realize this. But when they shoved it, it's the only book in print with the two words on it. There's not another book like it, greater than, more than, less than. And if it's not it, it's not it. And I don't know about you, but as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, all of us who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we admit to anyone that we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether it be within AA or out of AA or to anyone, how many of us stop and realize that when we admit that we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we have to admit that we're the results of what's in that book? Because in the first 12 chapters of that book, 11 chapters of that book, that's where our recovery program is in its entirety. Nowhere else. And it belongs to us. It belongs to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we can keep it as long as we're willing to give it away and share it in the manner in which it was given to us. And I don't know about you, but tonight, before I go to sleep, and I take my 10th step of this day, before I turn to the God of my understanding in the 11th step and thank Him for allowing a monkey like me to live sober this day in spite of me, I ask myself, what kind of member of Alcoholics Anonymous have I lived this day? Am I one of these who's had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, or am I one of these that wants you to believe that I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? That have memorized snatches and phrases and quotes, and oh, God can make the most beautiful talk you've ever seen and look real good on the outside, but on the inside I've got a concrete block big enough to land a 747. Have I lived the kind of life this day that if I'm asked to go to sit at the bedside of a sick, wet alcoholic or a member of Alcoholics Anonymous whose this day hadn't been too good? And just tell him about me. What's been given to me, what it used to be like, what happened, and how it is today. Have I lived the kind of a life that when I visit an alcoholic, that alcoholic says, yes, I want what you people have, and I'm willing to pick up my bed and walk with you. And every night I take that inventory, I find that I fall far short for what this alcoholic believes the true benefits that Alcoholics Anonymous gives us. We hear a lot of promises in Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's one promise we don't hear very much. And I believe we need to talk about it more and more and more and more and more. And that is a promise that God could and would if sought. That this power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And what's sanity in Alcoholics Anonymous? A sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sanity. Saneness of mind to realize who we are, what we are. And it's the first drink of alcohol that separates us from sobriety, separates us from God, separates us from the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have made it possible for us to come in and become a part of instead of apart from. I had many, many years to go before I was to realize this. I certainly did. And I remember they shoved that book in my hand and they used to call me boy. And they said, boy, bring that book to me. And I took that book over there and they said, look at that dust cover on there. What does it say? I said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, what's underneath the two words? I said, a circle with a triangle. They said, do you know what that means? I said, I don't know what it means. They said, now that is the logo of Alcoholics Anonymous. The symbol of Alcoholics Anonymous is not the praying hands. It's not a candle. It's not a cross. It's not a lighter. It is a triangle with a circle. Recovery, unity, service, circumscribed by the globe. And then they said, what does it say down at the bottom of that dust cover? I said, the basic text of alcohol. They said, that's it. If you start from anywhere else, it will not be in continuity. And then they said to me, turn the next page, open it up and turn the page. And I did, and it's a fly leaf, and it's vacant. There's nothing on there. And they said to me, what's on it? I said, nothing. And they say, you know why nothing's on that page? I says, no, sir. They said, because you don't know nothing. If you knew anything about living sober, you wouldn't need this book. And then they said, turn the next one. They said, what is that? I said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, what is it underneath? I said, that circle with the triangle. But he said, what's that at the bottom? And it says, copyright, AA World Services Incorporated. And they said, that's us. It's ours. And we can keep it only in the manner in which we're willing to share it and give it away. And then they said, turn the next page. And I did. And they said, when was this book printed? And I told them the year. And he says, now I'm going to give you the key. And the key is this. It says, David, there have been thousands and thousands and thousands of alcoholics such as you who have come to Alcoholics Anonymous who have tried to change what's in that book. David, the key is, let's what's in that book change you. Well, and I never will forget what they told me. It says, now, when you start to read that book, don't you turn at the end of that book, start reading them stories at the end, because you're not the end of your problem. And don't open it up in the middle of the book and start reading the middle of the book, because you're not the middle of your problem. You start from the front. Everything follows in place. And I'm so glad what was said this morning, that nowhere in our books or nowhere in AA's conference approved literature, period, is AA's definition of alcoholism. We only have a description of the alcoholic. And basically, and it was read a while ago, our description of the alcoholic. And basically, we have three descriptions of the alcoholic. And you don't have to hunt them too far. And they're found in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first one, more about alcoholism. There were men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. The great obsession that somehow, someday, we'll be able to control and enjoy our drinking. You gotta control it in order to enjoy it. The normal drinker don't have to control it in order to enjoy it. The second one is we agnostics, that if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount that you take. And A is very gentle. It says, you're probably alcoholic. I read that many years later, and I said, I was probably an alcoholic. And the third one is what? The first step. We admitted we were alcoholic, that our lives have become unmanageable. Twofold illness of mind and body. And so we don't treat alcoholism in AA. We treat the alcoholic. You know how we treat the alcoholic in AA? Real good. Real good. And so I started reading it, and I got to the doctor's opinion. And being a part of the medical profession, that interested me. And here's a little physician by the name of John William Silkworth, who treated over 40,000 alcoholics before AA got off the ground, and over 10,000 after AA got started. And he writes what this alcoholic personally believes, that 2.5 pages is the finest writing about our malady that's ever been put in print. The little wonderful doctor with the China blue eyes that Bill loved so dearly and who loved us so dearly. And it has to be the finest writing because it has stood the acid of time. And today it is the basis for every successful treatment modality in the world today for an alcoholic. And Silky writes that many women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That shot the balloon out of there. I thought I was drinking because of the kind of woman I was married to. I thought I was drinking because of those two rotten kids. I thought I was drinking because the Republicans was in and the Democrats was out. I thought I was drinking because of my color, my size, my hair, my religion. I thought I was drinking because I was recalled back into the service. No, no. Many women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And although we will admit it is elusive, we will admit it is injurious, there comes a time when we cannot differentiate the true from the false, and then the alcoholic believes his life to be the only one. Doesn't everybody get drunk on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day and Christmas and New Year's Eve and New Year's Day and St. Patrick's Day? And when the sun goes up and the sun goes down, the sun just lays there, you know. Silky writes, we're restless, irritable, and discontented. I was never restless and irritable and discontented. When I was drinking, I was drunk. It's in between drunks that I was restless, irritable, and discontented. And until we can again experience the ease and comfort which seems to come at once after taking a few drinks. Drinks that we see others taking with impunity. My wife used to say, why don't you drink like Herman? I said, I don't want to drink like Herman. I don't even like Herman. She said, why don't you drink like so-and-so? And I said, fine, get him over to the house Saturday night. He'd come over. I'd feed him alcohol like I'm drinking. Come on, don't drink like a little baby. Drink. Hour and a half later, so-and-so would be passed on his back on my living room rug. And my foot would be on his navel, and I'd look at my wife, and I'd say, and you want me to drink like this bum here? Grace used to say, why don't you drink like a man? I said, I'm drinking with both fists. What else you want me to do? Oh, here's a good one. People used to say, David, don't you drink anymore. I didn't need any more. What I was drinking was doing the job. But once we succumb to the desire again, and unfortunately many of us will, here comes the thing that separates our kind from the so-called social drinker. I was a social drinker. I drank with anybody. Normal drinker. I don't know what a normal drink for anybody is, but for me it used to be get a half pint of whiskey, knock the cap off, sucker down in one swallow, and go for the next one, you know. But once we succumb to the desire again, it sets up this phenomenon of craving for alcohol. My God, how my body craved alcohol when I was drinking. And that's where I found out what was wrong with me at that meeting. No, it wasn't what that woman said about Christ in her life. And it wasn't what those members of Alcoholics Anonymous talked about God's grace through the miracle in their lives of sobriety. It wasn't the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting that turned me off. No, 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 no. Remember I told you I got up at 5:30 that morning and started drinking. I drank a half a fifth. And I knew I was going to be required to have a drink. And the requirement wasn't what people used to tell me, David, you're sorry, you're no good, that you'd rather be drunk than sober. No, no. My body was screaming out for a drink. I had this thing, and I didn't know what it was. Nay, we called it a mental compulsion. That if we continue to drink, we'll die. We'll die. And it wasn't that. No, my body was screaming out for drink, and my head knew where that bottle was. And once an alcoholic that's drinking has that mental obsession to get that drink, that comes before family, it becomes before job, it comes before country, it comes before decency, it becomes before everything else because it is a form of mental sickness. So powerful. That condemns us to drink against our own will, no matter how many pledges, how many promises, how many this or how many that. And I wouldn't let me have a drink. And I was targeted for that. That's what was wrong with me at that meeting. And then Silky says that once we succumb and it sets up this phenomenon of craving and we go through that well-known spree, and we do it again and again and again and again and again. And here's where Dr. Silkworth lays out our recovery program prior to the chapter 1 in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, until such a person experiences an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for his recovery. And how in Alcoholics Anonymous do we experience an entire psychic change? As a result of our ideals that are firmly grounded in a power greater than ourselves. And how in Alcoholics Anonymous do we firmly ground our ideals in a power greater than ourselves? Steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. And our co-founders knew that we would be restless, irritable, and discontented. They knew that we would want more than, so they gave us 12 more spiritual principles to live by, call our 12 traditions. Not only how we live as sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous with each other in our groups, but our AA groups and relations to other groups and the world in which we live in. And that first tradition is, honey, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Common problem, common solution, common recovery, common father, the oneness of one. The oneness of one. And then after Dr. Bob died in 1962, Bill knew that we would still be restless, irritable, and discontented, and so Bill gave us 12 more spiritual principles to live by, called our 12 concepts of world service. So that the alcoholic who is born not too far from this facility right now, the alcoholic is laying out on his beach drunk and doesn't even know that there's another way, and that baby that's going to become an alcoholic will get as good a break and a good a deal as you and I have gotten since we come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had many years to go before I realized this. And then Silky says, what will happen to one such a person who's experienced this entire psychic change? A person who has been deemed helpless and hopeless and has so many problems they'll never be able to comprehend how they will ever be able to solve them, can now very easily control their desire for alcohol. The only thing being that they'd be willing to follow a few simple rules. Well, Dr. Silkworth, being a non-alcoholic, he says, rules. But us drunks, we don't like rules, we don't like regulations, we don't like to be told what to, what not to do, we just say suggestions. But after you've been sober for a while in AA, them suggestions become rules. Well, as soon as that meeting was over with, afterward, I ran through them folks like a tornado. And I ran out to my car and I got out that half bottle of whiskey, and I don't know about you, but I drank her down in two swallows, and that's the way I drank alcohol. I didn't put it in a brandy glass and run around and sniff it for 4 or 5 hours. And burn candles and incense and listen to Lawrence Welk. And I didn't put an inch in the glass, 9 inches of something else, and straw and a fruit and a cherry and half a Christmas tree on top of it, and suck on it for about 3 hours. And I drank her to drop her down that hole where it'd do the most good, and then put another one down there. But let me tell you what happened to me when I got her down there. I quit being restless, irritable, and discontented. I quit perspiring. My hair laid back down. My toes went back in those alligator shoes. I ran up the steps and got a hold of the oldest sober member that got sober in that group, and he's still alive, and the oldest sober in that member in that group got to arguing with him about the quality of y'all's fellowship. And he said something to me, and I hit him. And when I was drinking, I was bad to hit folks, taller than me, and shorter than me, and fatter than me, and skinnier than me. And two of his AA babies joined in, we started a fight. And I'll tell you right now, that fight, as far as I was concerned, was a lot better than that AA meeting. And I was just whooping the dickens out of them two little sober drunks. And they did an unfair thing to a drinking alcoholic. They send in two more alcoholics the size of outside linebackers on any professional football team. And finally, four of them picked me up bodily, two on each side, and threw me right out of that AA group. As I'm sailing through the air, one of them said, "We don't need your kind here." And another one said, "And furthermore, you're too young to be an alcoholic." And I stood on that grass that Sunday evening drunk with my fist clenched, screaming to anybody that would listen to me that I would never come back to this Christ soul-saving organization as long as I lived, that I was not an alcoholic, I was too young to be an alcoholic, but the next 17 years, everything that could possibly happen to a human being happened to this human being. And the only three things never did happen to me, getting ready to get on a drunk, coming off a drunk right to this second, is I never did willfully murder another human being, fall in love with another man, or die drunk. Other than that, it all happened. I'd married this wonderful gal. And God, when we got married, she didn't realize she'd married an alcoholic. And so when we got married, we didn't start to build a marriage. We started to build a booby trap. One that could go off on any month and any year. And I was recalled back in the service as a naval dental officer, didn't have to go, but it gave me a chance to get way away from my creditors and my nagging wife and everybody else, and I started running. And I went with a combat marine division, and I got into more trouble than there's trouble. Christmas Day, 1954. I'm laying in a prison with a leg iron locked around my right leg and a chain welded to the leg iron, the other end the chain welded steel cotton. four legs still tight immersed in concrete, and there are armed guards around me 24 hours. They daring me to move. And they had room for 128, and they were what they call the incorrigibles that would never get out of there. It was under a code name. Thank God later it was investigated in dynamite and bulldoze. It was worse than any prisoner of war camp ever devised by a man, and worse than any concentration camp that's ever devised by a man. And I'm laying there, and I didn't know how I got to realize why I was there until after I got there. And here it was, Christmas Day of 54, and I was to lay like that for one solid year. And I've been laying like that for 7.5 months, and because of my belligerence, and because of my uncooperativeness, and because of my hates, and my resentments, and my anger, 4.5 of those 7.5 months I was on straight bread and water. And Christmas Day in walks a little orderly with the Christmas meal, and I've been in a lot of places where they don't give you knives and forks, they give you a spoon. And they count you spoons before you go back to the little doggy house, you know. And no big deal, you learn how to eat soup with your fingers. And he comes in and he's grinning from ear to ear and he says, "Ho, ho, ho, Merry Christmas." And I'm so full of Christmas spirit and love for my fellow man, because I've been laying there all day hating society, because there were hundreds of people who had done far more than me, and I'm locked up and they're running free. Why me? Why me? Boo-hoo. And when he says, "Ho, ho, ho, Merry," I said, "Ho, ho, ho, you know what?" He says, "Well, here it is." And when he gave it to me, I was so full of gratitude, I picked up the tray and I hit him right in the face with it. And my Christmas gift for doing that on that Christmas day was 45 more straight days on bread and water. Now, that's what you call a bad day. I have not had a day that bad since I have been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got out of that by hook or crook. People took their lives as a result of their involvement with me, and there were some very serious amends to be made. I talked my wife into taking me back, and we started moving and moving and moving and moving, and we decided to move out to the panhandle of West Texas to raise our two little boys in a Christian environment. And I don't know about any of y'all ever living in a town in the panhandle of West Texas of 3,500 that lives in a Christian environment. That's a town that votes dry and drinks wet. And I'm drinking every day, and I get up to where I weigh 260 pounds, and my blood pressure was so high that every time my pulse would beat, my hair would stand straight and pump like an oil well. And I had a fat doctor friend that lived about 30 miles away. I went to see George. George takes one look at me. He says, "My God, you look sick." He said, "But let's take a drink before I examine you." That's a good doctor to go to when you drink it. And finally, he puts the bottle and the glasses up, and he puts the cuff around my arm, and he blows the air up, and he comes back down. He says, "My God, David, it's a miracle you're alive. Your pressure's high. But the reason is because you're too fat. And the reason you're too fat is because you're a compulsive eater, and I'm going to have to give you some help." And he wrote me a prescription for 60 of the most beautiful capsules I'd ever seen in my life called Nemudons. And I said, "Doctor, is it all right if I drink a couple of beers?" He said, "I don't believe it'll hurt you." He never should have told me that. So I went home, and I got the prescription filled, and went home to my house to lose weight and stay drunk. Well, I looked at the prescription. It says, "Take one 3 times a day after meals." Well, who eats when you drink? And every drunk knows if one's good, two's better, three's terrific. So I just took 3 of them, drank some whiskey. Didn't feel like I was losing any weight. Took 3 more, drank some more whiskey, ran into the bathroom, turned sideways, looked in the mirror. Didn't look like I was losing any weight. Come back to the table, took a handful of them, drank some more whiskey. Looked like my stomach's getting bigger. Our co-founder Bill wrote some very prophetic lines when he says, "You know, when a drunk is drinking, it's time out of mind. Time passes so slow." And Louise, the only thing I've found sad about Alcoholics Anonymous is time passes so fast sober. Where does it go? And finally, I took all the pills and drank all the whiskey. And the next thing I knew, I was out in my backyard and I was picking peaches off of rose bushes. I don't mind telling you. And they tell me I ran around that little town of 3,500 for 2 days talking in the unknown tongue. And being one of 2 Jewish families in 5 counties around, they gathered everybody in to see and hear the miracle. Because word had spread like wildfire. The Jew had caught the Holy Ghost, you know. And when I come to and realize what happened, I says, "My God, those pills are messing up my drinking, you know." Oh, I'd been to the psychiatrist, and all the questions he asked me, my wife, Grace, used to ask me for nothing, you know. Oh, we had to leave that town. We had to leave that town. We moved back to Dallas, and we started all over again with a wonderful opportunity. But I was taking me with me. And here is where the slide went all the way down. It went along before I was on that third skid row. And I'm sleeping in those 55-cent night hotel rooms with your shoes tied around your neck. Nothing fancy. They didn't have any walls in between your cot. They had chicken wire. Grace and the boys had long gone. My mother and father had prayed me dead. I couldn't stay sober, and I couldn't stay drunk, and I couldn't work, and I had no desire, and I didn't want to live. And no one knew where I was. And yet all Grace had to do was look out the west window of her office, because she went to work for with the people and in the area that I started drinking with as a youngster. An area she hated with every fiber of her being, but she went because these people had been friends of ours. And no one knew where I was, and yet all she had to do was look out the west window of her office, and she'd see me fall out of that wine hotel, and I'd crawl under those docks and those 18-wheelers, and I know that area just like I know the back of both of my hands and every hair on each hand, and I'm crawling and I'm looking for Grace. Because it's the only woman I've ever loved in my life, and she represented everything that the kind of a human being that I wanted to be. She was clean and she smelled good and everybody loved her. And she was the mother to those two little boys and she was the father to those two little boys. And she took them to the Little League and to the vacation and to the circus and everywhere else. And I wanted to. I didn't want to be the way that I was, but I couldn't stay sober. I'd take them to Little League and I'd say, I gotta go use the phone and show up in football season's on, you know. And I didn't want to be that way. Nobody in their right mind wants to be that way. I don't know about you. This one didn't. Maybe she could give me an answer. I went home once the last 9 months I drank. And I was drunk and I came in and Grace looked at me and she said, David, maybe there was something. Maybe she could turn me into somehow, some way. She looked at me and she says, David, do you have to drink and do the things that you're doing? And I guess I told her the first truth that I had told her since we were married. And I said, Grace, I can't stop drinking. Why don't you find another man that'll marry you? You're such a fine lady. And then she'll be a good husband to you and be a good father to those two little boys. I says, I can't function as a husband. I can't function as a father. I can't function as a professional man. I can't work. I can't stay sober. Grace, I don't want to live anymore. I want to die drunk. And I grabbed my wine bottle and I went out and I proceeded to do it. And somewhere along the line on April 18th and 19th of 67, I can't tell you when, I found the handwriting on the floor of the county jail there in Dallas, Texas. And I've been in lots of jails, and incidentally, being in jail is not a requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. By this time, I'd run out of people, I'd run out of me, I'd run out of whiskey, I'd run out of money. I couldn't stay sober, and I couldn't stay drunk, and I couldn't kill myself, and I couldn't stay alive, and I didn't want me as me was, but me screamed out, but me's going, me, every place me went. And I screamed out on that jail floor, my God, is there any help for me? And something within me said, listen, you overeducated, pompous, egotistical, spoiled little drunk, until you stop drinking, nobody can help you, not even me. And I know right this second that there was not only a God for me then in that jail floor, and right this second, because I'm still here and I have not had a drink of alcohol since I screamed that out. And how I got by that old sheriff, I don't know. I said, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to look up those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. This alcoholic had to exhaust everything. And when he comes to scream out that he couldn't stay sober and he couldn't stay drunk and he didn't want to live that way anymore, and I'd exhausted all alternatives for this alcoholic. Not you, but for this alcoholic. And the next to the last time I was in that jail, as I was led before that sheriff looked at me and he said, if you ever show up in my jail again for drinking or drunk and the things you do when drinking, I'm going to have you put away to where you'll never bother another human being, bird, tree, dog, or rock. And I tell you how well I heard him. I walked right out of his office, walked down the steps, walked down a half a block into the whiskey store, and got me another bottle of wine, and went out in the park and laid with the rest of them winos and pigeons in a grid, and as I beat him again. And this time, I didn't know whether I was going to get out. How I got by him, I don't know. I'm going to look up those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, over 34 years ago, a group of fine, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous who could see in me what I could not see in myself. They're like our co-founder, Bill, when he was in Akron before AA got started, before he even met Dr. Ma. And he didn't know whether to go into the bar in the Mayflower Hotel, whether to listen to the music, the conversation, and drink him a little soda water and ice and the rest of the things go in the bar, or talk to a drunk. And it wasn't important that Bill talked to another alcoholic to try to carry the message. It was important that Bill talked to another alcoholic so Bill would stay sober. And this is what those fine members of Alcoholics Anonymous doing me over 34 years ago. It was for their sobriety. But they planted a seed in me that once I'd exhausted and uncovered everything that David had to uncover to get down to where he wanted to stay sober more than anything else in this world. When I got out, I started hunting for Edith. The gal asked me to come. I heard she had passed away, but she was continuously sober. I heard that Moena had moved away. I see Moena on a weekly basis. And last May the 22nd, Moena celebrated her 35th continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a man at that meeting that was sober. He was sober 8 years. He drank for 8 years. Last May the 24th, he was sober 19 continuous years. I called him up. He won't know who is it for. And I said, it's for me. And he said, well, we have a meeting tomorrow night. Let's just go and get it over with. And don't you take a drink of alcohol today and call me in the morning at 7:30. And after 37 and a half years of drinking, it's cold turkey. Well, it's more like frozen buzzard, if you want to know the truth about it. I started walking and shaking out a drunk. And when I come to the next morning, I was sober and I didn't have a belly full of tranquilizers, nor did I have a prescription for 500 more. And for this, I am so thankful. And I called him at 7:30 in the morning and he said, are you drinking? And I said, no, sir. He said, don't you take a drink of alcohol today and call me at 3:30 this afternoon. And he hung up and it started that walking and that shaking and that jumping. And finally at 3:30, I called him again and he said, are you drinking? And I says, no, sir. He said, do you really want to come to an AA meeting? Well, by this time, I was willing to walk through 8 feet of snow naked just to see what kind of people you were that had this insatiable desire not to drink alcohol. And I said, more than anything in the world, he said, do you want me to come pick you up? And being about as humble as Hitler, I said, I'll get there under my own steam. He said, well, I tell you where it is. When you turn the corner, there's a whiskey store on the left. There's a beer garden on the right. Don't you stop and buy any consuming alcohol. Don't you be drunk when you get out there, because when I search and smell you, if you're drinking or drunk, I'm going to throw you right through the front door. You, David, cannot come to Alcoholics Anonymous drinking or drunk. Now, I know that is not the accepted principle, but I'll tell you a little story. He was one of them drunks that I was just whooping the dickens out of on that Sunday afternoon, and he didn't want no part of me drinking. And that's the greatest thing in the world he could told for me, that I had to be sober to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I was in a terrible predicament. My wife had long thrown out all my clothes. And when I got out of jail, I was in the same thing I'd been in for around about 4 months, and that was an old pair of gray flannel pants with all my possessions in the pocket, and a pair of dirty thermal underwear, an old gray sweater with the elbows out, the elbows, no socks, but I still hadn't quite lost everything yet. I had a pair of beat-up old alligator shoes, and the only money I had was 30 cents, and that was all that was left from the last blood I sold to Blood Bank to buy wine. And when you come to AA in that shape, you ain't doing too well. I don't mind telling you. And I heard she'd thrown out all my clothes. So I called her up, and she hadn't heard from me, and she wanted to know who it was. And I said, me. She said, who's me? I said, David. She said, what do you want? I said, Grace, do you happen to have one of my old suits? And she says, yes, I have one, and it's to bury you, isn't it? As I look back now, I then ask her the most foolish question I ever asked her in my life. I said, do you mind if I borrow it for a little while? That I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, it's another one of your lies, and hung up. And that suit's a story in itself. And we moved again, incidentally, 4 times since we've been sober. And I hide that suit, and I take it with me, and I'll tell you when I'll get home tomorrow. There's a wonderful member of Alcoholics. Now, I love him more dearly than anything in this world.
He's going to talk to you in the morning, and I'm not saying it because he's here. He has the greatest line that I ever heard. And he calls me Kid. And the only other one that ever called me Kid was one of the most tremendous members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was my pleasure ever to meet and to love. And he called me, and he told me that he was my friend. An alcoholic by the name of Dick Breen. A tremendous member of Alcoholics Anonymous. No, you won't read in the Business Week that he was a multi-billionaire. You won't read that he owned insurance companies or banks. He had the greatest possession that a human being could have. Sobriety as a result of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he worked with drunks. God, he was a tremendous man. A tremendous man. And I am so thankful that but John has this great line. He says, Kid, the 6 inches separates a halo from a noose. How true. How true. Well, I got on that old suit. Now, when I went home, put on that old suit, there wasn't instant love when she let me in that house, put on that suit. Everything I touched and looked at, she'd spray. And the youngest kid was home, and the oldest one was gone. I never educated my two sons. You ain't got time when you're drinking. Gets in the way. And I bid them goodbye, and I got into a Mustang that the bank was looking to repossess it, but it couldn't recognize it looked like an accordion. And off I went to the meeting. And I walked in, and it looked like the same people that were there 17 years prior. And one of them looked at me and he grinned and he said, we knew you'd be back. And now I'm going to tell you about the greatest AA talk I've ever heard in my life. And it came out of the words of Dick Breen. And another alcoholic heard it. And he heard it in the group that I came into. And there's an alcoholic that used to stand at the door. He's a sober member of AA, and he stands at the door and greet all the new people. As I come through the door, he stuck out his hand. I grabbed it. Mine was wet. His was dry. Mine slipped away, and I had to grab it again. And I've been privileged to hear many, many talkers. We don't have any speakers in AA. We're just a bunch of talkers. Ours is the language of the heart. And I've been fortunate enough to hear our co-founder, Bill, quite a few times, young in sobriety. Not because I went, I was drugged to hear him. They drugged me to hear it. And many, many tremendous talkers in Alcoholics Anonymous. But this is the greatest AA talk I've ever heard in my life, and if your group hadn't told you this, then you have been cheated. This man then said to me, as Dick had told me, welcome, come in and sit down and have a cup of coffee and let's talk about it. We understand exactly how you feel. He didn't tell me you never should have done those things. He didn't tell me if you really loved me, you wouldn't have done those things. He just simply said, welcome, come in and sit down and have a cup of coffee and let's talk about it. We understand exactly how you feel. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking that anybody shook my hand. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking that anybody told me to come in and didn't say leave. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking that anybody says, we understand exactly how you feel. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking anyone asked me to sit down and share anything with them. And then when the meeting started, it was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking anybody asked that I sit with them. And I'm sitting there, and I'm shaking, and I'm jumping, and the alkies on either side of me, and they got their hands on my knees and arms. And they said, easy does it, first things first. And then when the meeting was over, it was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking that anyone allowed me to stand and pray with them. And when they said the Lord's Prayer, I didn't know the Lord's Prayer. And no one called me a heathen, and no one called me an atheist, and no one called me a dummy. And the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking, the people walked up to them and they hugged me and they shook my hand. And the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking, when I got ready to leave, people said to me, David, please come back. We need you, and you need us. We. You know, we are normally people who would not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship and a friendliness that's indescribably wonderful. And now for a few short moments, I'd like to tell you how it is today. Little did I realize when I got to you people that my wife and two sons would ever be under one roof again. Because that marriage had been written off by everything and everybody, and it had no right to be. But only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and only because of God's grace through the miracle of Al-Anon in Grace's life, that beautiful and wonderful lady. We celebrated our 41st wedding anniversary this past June the 10th, and if she behaves this coming June the 10th, I'll let her celebrate 42 with me. And incidentally, that's AA's birthday. Now, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you, because I'm in AA and Grace's and Al-Anon, that our marriage is just beautiful and perfect, that the bluebirds are flying around, that the butterflies are hugging and cooing and winking. Heck no. We have a few short rounds every now and then. We have a few long rounds every now and then. That's what you call clearing the air, communicating. And the best way I can describe our marriage today, it's built on solid, constructive imperfection. Because it's by our imperfections that we grow. And anyway, Grace goes to 4 or 5 Al-Anon meetings a week, and I go to 6, 7, 8 meetings a week, and we don't see each other enough to have all that nitpicking, arguing, fighting, and fussing. But you know, I am so thankful that Grace married me, but I'm more thankful that she stayed. Our two sons, God, they're tremendously successful today. And the oldest one, when he was 15 years of age, had a butcher knife in my breastbone. He's going to kill me for what I was doing to the mother. Wildness left his eyes, dropped the knife, he spat in my face, and he said, "You're no longer my father, and I'm no longer your son," and he walked out of my life, and that hurt me. But only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and the family life, and the family of what we call living on spiritual principles. And what spiritual principle of living? Living the truth with all of our defects of character and what ain't defects God's given us. I don't know about your family, but allowing every member of our family to be ourselves as we are, allowing every member of our family the freedom to be ourselves as we are and the freedom to make our own mistakes. You see, if I hadn't been free to make my mistakes, I never would have found you. And when I found you, what's the first thing you said to me? "David, if you don't take the first drink of alcohol, there's no way in the world you can get drunk one day at a time." And what's the first question I asked you? "But how do you live without alcohol?" And you said, "David, if you decide that you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps." And in taking the steps, before I was halfway through the ninth step, this God that you said that could and would was suddenly doing for me what I could not possibly do for myself. And I never would have found that wonderful experience if I hadn't been free to make my mistakes, free to find people who had made the same mistakes, but more important, people who weren't continuing to living in those mistakes. They had found a solution. And I didn't have to pay for that solution. They didn't charge me for that solution. They say, "Here it is for free and for fine." They were going to remove my license to practice my profession for the rest of my life. Not to give me a suspension and not to give me a vacation, but to retire that number. And I had to go down and I had to go tell them the truth. Not make promises. Promises kill drunks. What I've done. And I was down there a week. And they said, "Well, go back to work. We'll be watching you one day at a time." I've been allowed to go back to work. And so you see, only because of God's grace, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a sober life today. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of the recovery program, I have a God today, a God of my very own. A God that I found through the big book and the 12 steps, through you people and from nowhere else. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a family that loves and respects me. I have the best way to make a living I've ever had in my life. I have hundreds of thousands of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, Al-Teen, the world in which we all live. I have a roof over my head. I have a few dollars in my pocket and a few dollars in the bank, very, very few. I have 2 cars with gasoline in them, I hope. I have some reasonable, nice clothes today. I have meat in the refrigerator and groceries in the pantry, and I'll tell you a little secret. If you want anything any more than that, you either oversexed or plumb nuts. And you've been so good. And I'd like to leave you with a little thing. And think about it. There's a letter that is framed in our General Service Office in our archive. And it was a letter that was written to our co-founder, Bill, on December the 30th, 1946. It was written by a man whose family name is perhaps the most famous and outstanding name, family name, in finance and banking and energy and oil and coal and you name it, and foundations in this world. A man who dearly loved the drunks. And he wrote Bill this letter thanking Bill for a wartime edition of the big book that Bill had sent him and had written a little inscription in the flyleaf. And that was the first paragraph, but I'd like to share with you the rest of the letter. And the letter says this, that it must be of great satisfaction for you to realize that the helping hand that you extended to a needy brother many years ago has resulted and the widespread extension of that brotherly act. The regenerating power of the spirit of that helping hand has been the means by which countless of thousands of alcoholics whose lives had been saved that otherwise would have been hopelessly wrecked. May God continue to bless you and use you ever increasingly as his chosen instrument in the rebuilding of broken lives. Thank God he didn't say saving souls. Now, we didn't invent this. And so we're all here as a result of an alcoholic that we don't hear very much in Alcoholics Anonymous about, and I think we need to talk more and more and more about an alcoholic by the name of Ebby Thatcher, who called on Bill, and then called on Bill again when Bill was in the hospital. And if you read the book, and I'm not going to read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous to you, in Bill's story, when he went over the deal again, and the steps that Bill took after, and the when Bill said, if there is a God, let him show him to me. It was after Ebby had talked to him. The link. Ebby got it from Roland. And then Bill to Bob and the widespread. We're all here as a result of that helping hand and the widespread extension of that helping hand and for no other reason, period. And so if there's a wish, if there's a prayer that I have for each and every one of us in Alcoholics Anonymous, not only in this meeting tonight, that we continue to let God bless us and use us ever increasingly as his chosen instrument in the rebuilding of broken lives. And how do we continue to let God bless us and keep us? In words that we hear all the time, that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Neither endorses nor imposes any. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And I believe that's the only way that God will continue to bless us and use us ever increasingly as his chosen instrument in the rebuilding of broken lives. God bless each and every one of you, and thank you so much.